Live from the library, this time on Technology IQ.
To this edition of Live from the Library for Technology IQ. For more information on these internet seminars and other information at Tech IQ, visit welchwrite.com/Tech IQ. That's welchwrite.com/Tech IQ. We do these internet seminars twice a month, the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, and we then put them on the website, and you'll also see them there as an audio podcast. So welcome, everybody. As always, we have our regulars here in the classroom tonight. Normally, we do right off the bat kind of a question and answer. I usually have something to demo, but normally it's more internet-related and more website-related. Today, I'm actually going to do a kind of a hands-on. I'm going to show you something, mainly because I did something today that I needed to do, and I realized, wow, this is actually a great thing to do. So I went and got one of these today. This is an external hard drive, a 500 gigabyte external hard drive. Now, what the funny thing is this is the second one I bought in like the last 3 weeks. What I'm going to do basically is I'm going to unbox it because, frankly, most of us are coming to the days where we're starting to need, if we're doing anything, if we're starting to get our podcasts, you know, for our entertainment, we're starting to get videos online, we're maybe even making our own videos, the wide variety of things we're doing, we can actually chew up hard drive space pretty quickly. And if nothing else, you need one of these. I'm recommending everyone get an external hard drive for backup these days. Because there's no reason these days to lose data. There really isn't. There's free online backup choices like mozy.com, which I've talked about in the past, mozy.com. There is inexpensive hard drive. This hard drive, 500 gigabytes. Well, first of all, 3 years ago, if you could have gotten a drive this big, it would have cost you probably $10,000.
Whoa!
I don't think I'm overestimating that out there in the chat room. This was $140 at Costco.
You're kidding.
Now, of course, the hardest part of using any new electronic device is getting it out of the packaging.
That's so true.
This one is not as bad as some others in that if you just rip the cardboard, you can then get the little clamshell out here. And if you're listening to this as an audio podcast, I forgive you for the loud noises. So, you end up with a little thing in a little plastic clamshell.
How much data would that?
It actually says on the box, Joe, hand me that back. It gives some estimates here. It would hold up to 200 hours of DVD quality video, up to 142,000 digital photos, up to 125,000 songs in MP3 format. So that's some gross estimations of it, but you know that's the type of volume
so
you're talking about.
So even if your computer gets it's a little older, something like that.
Yeah, this still helps you out. Basically, it will only go as fast as your computer goes. But the fact is, if you're using it for backup, it really doesn't matter how fast it is. It's more that the data gets on it reliably.
Okay, so, but your podcasting takes up.
My podcasting can take up quite a bit. Well, mine is not. See, that's the nice thing. Podcasts are not DVD quality. Those are DVD quality. Big, huge, multi-gigabyte files. My podcasts are under 100 megabytes.
Oh, okay.
Even the longer ones. They have a few that are longer, but okay. Here in the what is my right-hand side, you're going to notice there's some cables in here. And that's actually very interesting because on the front of the box here, you see there are a couple of logos. I'm going to hold it up to the camera here and hold it up to you as well. Right here, kind of hard to see in the camera, but right here there's it says USB 2.0 and FireWire 400. Okay? That means this drive can be connected to your computer using two different methods. Okay? One is via the USB, which you're probably already familiar with. I'm sorry, USB, which you're already familiar with. You know, the flat on one end and the square on the other. This is a FireWire cable, which you may or may not have seen before. It has kind of a D-shaped connector on both ends. See there, guys? D-shaped connector. Or you can have this on one end and then a small one, another kind of smaller square-shaped one like the USB, and that is I think they call it a C-type connector. Usually you see that for camcorders. That's how you plug in your camcorder to your computer. It's going to be with a firewire cable with that on one end. They do that for miniaturization because they want the connector on the camera to be as small as possible. Okay, so this one supports both, and I will say they gave us both cables that we could use that we might need, so that's another great thing. The other thing that's on that right-hand side of that container was your power adapter. Most devices these days, in order to keep the drive as small as possible, they give you an external power adapter. So basically it means the power supply for this unit is external. It just plugs in. Now I will say these are sort of nice. You see how the prongs are offset there? That allows you to plug this into a power strip without taking up more than one strip. We call these wall warts.
Yeah.
Because typically they end up blocking your connector, your other outlets and all. There are some
those big ones do that.
Yeah, there are some power strips now that provide for that. They give you separated, or there's even a thing called a squid, which has basically separate extension cables coming out, so they just do this and you can just separate them as much as you need. There's actually little pigtails you can buy fairly inexpensively that do that with any power strip. You plug it into the power strip, and then you plug the wall wart into it, and then you can fully use everything in your power strip without blocking any cables. So this is the this is our power supply. So those are the cables that are in the box. You know, typically you got your manual, quick install guide. I looked through this when I first got mine. Because I'm not using it as maybe you would. I'm basically using it as just a big honking drive. There is some software that comes with this. It's already on the drive, and it is backup software that you put on, and you can set it up to automatically back up your computer to this drive. I don't use it that way. I use some other stuff with my Mac to do that, but that is at least gives you some basic level of protection right there off the bat.
Now, is this taken? My old computer, they were going to take my hard drive out of my old computer, put it into my new computer as a backup.
Right.
This is the same thing, only this is external.
This is external. It can be moved from, say if you had multiple computers, you could use it on multiple computers. Okay. You can use it to move data from one computer to another. I don't know if you heard that on the microphones there, but basically she has a computer and they took her old drive and they put it in her new computer. Mainly we do that to ease our copying of data, because then it's hard drive to hard drive speeds and it's very fast, at least as fast as it can be. So that's one method. And then you end up with it. Then once you make sure all your data is moved to the new drive, you can actually erase that secondary drive and then use it for backups and other stuff. Now, I will say this is a little more useful for backups in that you can take this off-site. If you do a full backup, and then if you have the ability, you can take this to your parents' house, to your friend's house, whatever, kind of swap hard drives so that should anything untoward happen to your apartment or your house, you've at least got some data somewhere where it didn't get destroyed. So that's one of the benefits of having something like this. There's a lot of benefits to having an external drive. That's just a few of them. Basically, if we look at the back here, make this so both of you can see it there, we have our USB connector here, the square connector, like we saw on the end of the USB cable. And then we have two FireWire connectors. FireWire is sort of neat in that you can daisy chain devices. You can go from the computer to one device, to the next device, to the next device, to the next device. And it supports that so that you don't have to have a cable leading from every device back to your computer, because you only have so many ports on your computer.
Right, right.
My Mac Mini only has, and this only has one FireWire port, but I can attach, I think, up to, I want to say six drives or something. That's probably more than that, isn't it, guys? You can correct me in the chat room. So you can daisy chain them together. That's why there's two FireWire ports and only the one USB. The USB, you must be connected directly. Now, it could go into a USB hub, which is a way of taking one USB port and making it into many. This could then plug into the hub, and that's how you can connect multiple devices that way. Okay? Joe, can you do me a favor?
Mm-hmm.
I would like you to, I think you may have to plug it in over here, though. We'll get my assistant in the plan here. Can you plug it in right
now?
See if it'll fit in there, Joe. I don't know if it'll work there or not. You have to turn that just a hair. There you go. Okay.
Because
use the end of the cable. Use the end of the thing to pry it open. There you go. See? It's a little trick. Ah, yeah, that'll work. So you plug that in.
So what do you pay your assistant?
Room and board. And he goes through shoes like they're going out of style, don't you? Okay, so on this device, this has a fire. My lap. I'm using a Windows Vista laptop, by the way, here at class. This just happens to be my travel machine. I use a Mac at home. This does have a FireWire connector, but it has the small connector, and I do not have a cable with me to connect to that.
Ah, okay.
But I do have, as we saw before, the USB cable, and so we can use that to actually plug it into the computer and see what it does. I just pressed a little button on the front, and that basically powers it up. In most cases, these hard drives you're going to leave on all the time. They will put themselves to sleep after a certain amount of non-use. And you'll see it kind of go, little lights go, and it fades out. But the next time you go to touch it, it automatically starts and wakes back up. So, as we said before, on the back, we have that square USB connector. Boom, plug that in. And if you can actually, you can, it's not real loud. That's another reason I got a second one of these, because the first one I got, they're very quiet. And when, of course, I'm recording, I don't want all that fan noise and heavy noise. So it's very nice that they're very, very quiet. Now, there's an interesting rumor slash truth about the 1 terabyte version of this. Basically, it's Big Brother, double the size, in that it has something on there that prevents you from pirating CDs and videos.
Interesting.
Built into the drive,
really?
Which, of course, all of us are like, what do you mean you're going to control what I can put on the drive? So I did not buy the bigger one. I didn't really want a 1 terabyte drive in one fell swoop. But just to be aware of that, just these Western Digital drives, I'm still trying to suss out exactly how true that might be. If you are in the stream, let me know. Maybe you can give me a URL to go to that article. Okay, I have 2 USB ports on this side. I have 1 on this side, and I'm just going to plug this in, and you're going to hear something. Hear that? That's the standard Windows tones that say, okay, hey, wait, I see something new, and hopefully it will know what to do with it.
Oh, it is.
Sometimes it doesn't. It says installing device driver software down here, and we can actually pop that little balloon open, and it says ready to use.
Does that mean it's installed already?
Yeah. With hard drives, there's not a whole lot that it has to do. You'll notice the little access lights in the front going round and round and round. Here, I'll see if I can show that on the video. Mm-hmm. See the little lights going around? And that shows you the activity. And it also is supposed to, again, I don't use the software that comes with it, but I believe the software that comes with it also will show you how full. It gives you an indicator. It gives you a gas gauge, if you will, of how full the drive is using the lights on the front. I haven't actually tried that. Now, this drive, too, I have it standing upright. You can just as easily lay it down. They're designed to work in both.
Is this much different than other, external drives?
No, they're all going to operate almost exactly like this. Now, there is a pocket drive you're seeing, and I've seen them as big as 250, which is like half the size of this one capacity-wise. I saw one today, in fact. They're about this big, about that thick, and they have no external power. They actually power themselves entirely off the USB.
What's the little stick,
That's a flash memory drive. This physically has a spinning drive in it. A standard hard drive like you have in your full computer.
Okay.
The flash memory sticks are literally memory.
Just to transfer.
And, well, they're smaller. Like, my stick is, you can get up to, I think, 16, 24 gigabytes now. They're still smaller than you can get in a hard drive like this. And, for example, you can't get 500 gigs in a laptop in most cases because the drives physically are too big. The flash memory are literally just memory. They're totally solid state. There are no moving parts. This has a moving part. You can actually put your hand on it and feel the disk spinning just like you can with any hard drive. Okay? So now that it mounted up and said, yes, okay, fine, I see it, and everything seems to be fine. Shut down my Gmail here. Oh, yes, I know. Go ahead. Let's go to my computer. So we go to our start menu. We go to my computer. And boom, right there, devices with removable storage. Actually, that's the wrong one. Where is it at?
Which one?
There's
right
a WD
there.
MyBook. So this is called a Western Digital MyBook. MyBook drive at 465 gigabytes free of 465 gigabytes. So it's basically empty.
It used up stuff just getting on there?
You always only get a nominal use. You never get a full rated amount. This is a 500 gigabyte drive. 465 is about right because there's overhead There is data the drive needs to store in order to be able to put data on it. The format and the indexes, the tables that allow you to see, to allow it to find where files are, take up some space in themselves.
Okay.
So you'll never get the full volume that they list on the box. That's actually a good question, because people often ask that about, well, I bought an 80 gig drive and it's only got 72 gig. It's like, yeah, I know. And it actually has to do with how it's formatted too.
I guess if you think about it, you realize it.
I know this is very basic and everything, but like gigabyte, for instance, how much?
It's a gigabyte is 1,024 megabytes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And about how much?
A floppy was 1.4 megabytes of data. Okay. This would store.
I mean, like
900 and some of them, if you will. An average text document, like a Word document, it's between. This is probably an old status, but I would say 2 and 4 kilobytes, and there are 1,000 kilobytes in a megabyte, right? Mm-hmm. I would take that.
So I mean, how much information, whatever, like in 1 gigabyte, would you say? Or like a movie, like a.
Yeah, a movie in iPod format, a movie in a compressed format would be around a gig, 2 gigs. Music, it comes in at, you know, several megabytes. So that's why, you know, 125,000 songs, if you will, at that format. Text takes up the very least. Pictures probably next. Audio probably is bigger, and then video is the biggest. And then databases, if you have a collection, large enough collection of data, you could have, you know, gigabytes of contact information for every customer you've ever had. You know, that can grow to be fairly sizable too. Mm-hmm. But typically it's audio and video that are taking up most of your space.
How are you going to individualize or between your different My Books now?
You name
you
them.
Stick a label on
you actually
you
name, well,
them?
Physically or computer-wise?
Well, just even physically.
Physically, yeah, I'm going to have to stick, I'm going to have to stick a little, I have a little P-Touch label. I'll probably put, you know, storage 2, this will be storage 2, I think.
Yeah. So now myself, I wouldn't have to, because
if you only had one,
I'd be doing one, but you're going to be.
Now I have enough drives that I need to start thinking about it.
Yeah.
And also online, then you would actually name them differently.
You're going to have to name it.
This one, if you right-click on this, I think, let's see here, to rename, I can actually turn this from this default name of My Book to, you know, Welch 3. And it should rename it. See, now the whole disk is called Welch 3. Now, out of the box, this comes formatted in what's called, it's an older way of storing data on the drive, which came about from the old DOS days, called FAT32, okay? The reason they do that is if you plug this into a Mac can actually read and write FAT32 and soak in Windows. So you can actually plug this into either or and it will work. Windows itself has another file system called the NTFS, and the NT file system, which Macs can't. Well, I think they can maybe read only, but they can't write to the drive. And then Macs have their own format. But what I'm going to do when I get home is actually reformat this drive into totally a Mac format, because that's where I'm going to use it. And there are some limitations with file names and storage. Like under FAT32, I can't make one file that's bigger than 2 gigabytes under FAT32. Well, guess what? When I do a movie sometimes, I can have a file that's actually one movie clip, say, you know, 10 or 12 minutes, or say a class like this, it's over 2 gigabytes in size. Well, the drive would not physically be able to store that with the way the data is laid on the disk now. Where if I format it as a Mac drive, I can break that barrier and go on to much larger contiguous files. I mean, in the old days, we never had to worry about running up into hard limits like that of, you know, who would ever make one file that's bigger than 2 gigabytes? But nowadays, it's actually fairly easy to do.
But with you, all your podcasts, and just even these classes that you've got on your computer?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, and in the case of the classes, I don't really have them on my computer. These are all recorded at Ustream, and they stay there. Thank goodness.
So they're out. Okay.
Thank goodness.
All right.
The audio I do, though, and an hour's worth of audio can be, it's 40 to 50 megabytes, I think, per class. By the time I actually send it down the podcast pipe. So they can, and if you figure, I've been doing career opportunities now. I've been podcasting that for, well, I'm in my fourth year, so I'm like 3.25 years in.
And you do that all in, like, you stream, or you?
I do that myself. Those files are stored on my own site.
They are.
Yeah. The audio is stored on my own site, because they're smaller. They're only 5 to 6 minutes. But if you consider 51 columns a year, or now 52 columns a year, for 3.5 years. Plus, I've gone back into my written archives and actually done, at times I've been doing 2 a week. So that's over 500 shows that I've done. And all those are sitting on my hard drive. And I do back them up to CD and archive stuff on occasion, but, you know, they have to have some place to live.
So when it gets filled up,
I archive them off to DVD or CD.
Do.
Yeah.
All right.
That's the typical path.
The
typical path is you move into what we call offline storage. You move them to something that you can stick in a book. I have a big, in the old days of CD players in your car, where you had the big, huge portfolio that had room for 48 or 120 CDs,
yeah.
I bought one of those. And when I make backups, I slam them in there, and then I roll the old backups off to another place. So it's kind of a whole pattern of things that I do.
And how long are they going to stay?
They don't know. Some people say 2 years. Some people say 40 years.
It's more than 2 years.
There've been some. Pardon me. There's been some worries about how long CDs and DVDs will last. Mm-hmm. They've had some issues with some very cheap CDs actually delaminating, starting to peel apart after only 5 years. The bigger problem, though, is not the failure of the medium. It's the failure of a device to read the disc you've made. I mean, we're already experiencing that in large companies. They have backup tapes or storage of data, and they don't have any machine to read it. There's no physical machine that can physically read those volumes any longer. It's like, imagine a world where there were no turntables anymore, and you had all these vinyl albums. What do you do with them? And this is the type of thing we're experiencing. And then you get into, in large corporations and libraries and such, you get into actual data migration, where you have to realize that we're going to lose this data if we don't move it to a different format. And so every so often, you've got to be thinking about rolling it to a new format, rolling it to a new storage. You know, the one saving grace is we're ending up with larger devices that can hold more data at one spot. So it's not like for every page that we used to store on microfilm, it takes a page, you know, in a folder, in a file cabinet somewhere. Now we can take whole collections of microfilm and microfiche, digitize them, and put them on 10 DVDs.
We do that. You know, I used to do our, you know, all, like, I'm accounts payable, so all my files used to get read and stuck on a microfiche. And if I wanted to go find a check, and oh my God, what's
yep.
the I had to go to the machine. Well, we still have that, but now all my stuff is gone. I get a CD disc back. And I'll just
with microfiche, you're at least safe from the fact that you, with a big enough magnifying glass and a big enough light source, you will always be able to read those.
I know.
That's what some people say about paper, too. Paper has proven over throughout history to be one of the most resilient, actually, storage beyond stone tablets, to be one of the more resilient data storage formats. And I mean, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are written on papyrus.
Yeah.
I mean, things have lasted thousands of years. But unfortunately, we've deforested our planet in order to store how many cattle got sold to Job, you know, back in year 200, you know, BCE or whatever. So there are limitations to the paper storage.
Just even this unit that you have here, eventually the computer people are going to go nuts and change something where that won't plug into your...
Right. Now, I will say with USB, with USB, they've been very good about keeping backward compatibility. Like, remember this said USB 2.0?
Yeah.
2.0 is a faster speed, uses the same connectors, though. So if I plug this into an older machine, it will complain to me a little bit saying, if you plug this into a USB 2.0 port, I could go faster, but it will still work. And so it's up to the manufacturers to have some backward compatibility built in there.
But you know what I'm saying? They just...
Well, they just announced at CES, the big consumer electronics show this week, they announced USB 3.0.
Yeah.
Now, it's not going to be out until, I think, they said 2012 or something, so we don't have to worry about it yet. But it is backward compatible with 2. I don't know if it's backward compatible with 1, but it might be.
That's part of what they were talking on that show about. At the show, a lot of the stuff is so futuristic that they're showing, not so futuristic, but not going to be available. And some of the people were kind of whining about...
Oh, because people see things... I called it the Mac Week Syndrome.
Yeah.
There used to be a tablet. We used to... Back in the old days of the computers, when I was working at Walt Disney Imagineering back in the 90s, I had a stack of magazines in my office every week this fall because there were trade magazines. There were 20, 30, 40 trade magazines.
Were you at Lit?
Yeah.
I worked at Lit.
I was there from 80... I want to say 89 to 92 or something like
that. Well, I was there when I was in my... Way, way young.
Oh, way, way, way
young. Ago.
1401 Flower? Or?
Yeah.
I worked in that building.
Did you?
Still there, too. They haven't torn it down yet.
Secretary of Green.
I met John. We had these conversations with me.
I was 19.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was...
You worked with the nine old men.
40-some years ago, yeah.
Claude Coates and Mark...
Don Akron, and they went to New York for the
World's Fair. Oh, boy.
I was one of the first that got to ride down the Matterhorn.
Jeez.
Well, before this, it wasn't open in the park.
Now, where was I headed with that? I was headed somewhere.
Sorry.
Totally don't remember.
Oh, dear.
You asked about upgrading. Oh, trade magazines.
Yes, that's what
we used to have so many stacks of trade magazines, and one of the trade magazines was there were a lot of them were weekly, so it was Mac Week, not Macintoshes. And I called it Mac Week syndrome because people would see something in Mac Week and immediately want to have it. And it's like, you don't need it, but I want it because it's cool. And that's the syndrome that you get into with CES, is there are so many cool things there.
Everybody
that you
does.
So desperately want them. And, you know, do we really need a 150-inch LCD television? Probably not. I think it comes at 100. Someone said, I heard a quote, $1,000 an inch.
Is that? Oh,
so $16,000 for one of these TVs.
Well, everybody, you get sucked up in that. I mean, I bought a Shuffle.
Uh-huh.
I haven't even used it. But then for Christmas, I bought myself an iPod Nano.
The new one, the fatty, as we call them.
The little fatty. She thinks 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yep.
Had to have an ingredient and paid $50.
Now, you have to be careful because, of course, you know the iPod is the gateway drug. Yeah, they've actually proven there's this iPod afterglow effect.
No kidding.
Which people get the iPods and they get used to iPods and iTunes and it's like, you mean the whole Mac works this way? Yeah, and it's like all of a sudden they find them at the Apple store buying their MacBook or whatever, you know, yeah, just sucks them right in, boy. Gotta watch that. Careful. this drive, back to the drive a little bit. So I've renamed it. Again, if I just double click it, boom, there it is. And you'll see there is some software on already. There's Windows, the Windows tools here. And there are the Mac tools here. And you can set this button to do various things, turn it on, turn it off, start a backup. If you have the automatic backup software loaded, touching the button would start a backup right now.
You have to tell it to back something up, though. Don't
you have to set up the backup first. If you want it to be automatic, you have to go and install the software and say, okay, when I touch a button or every so often, here's what I want you to back up.
You have to touch that button?
If you want to do it on demand.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, it's a time thing where you say, I want you to back up every day, every Thursday night, back up the stuff.
My computer does it up.
Right. That's the type of thing. I would install that software, except I realize it looks like it has to restart, and I don't really want to go through a complete restart tonight. But you install the software, and it will step you through the process and ask you, which folders do you want to back up? In your case, you're going to back up your documents folder, which contains my music, my pictures, you know, and the variety of other stuff. That's where Windows holds its stuff. On a Mac, we might back up the home folder. It's rare. Well, when you get in drives this big, you can back up your entire computer and tell it to basically track every change so that you basically have a complete backup all the time. But it takes a lot of space. It takes exactly the amount of space you're using on your hard drive. So as drives have come down in price, that's become more a viable alternative. I still tend to basically back up my data. The data is the one thing I cannot recreate easily. And so my first concern, my first priority is always to back up my data, my pictures, my documents, my audio, my video. Nowadays, again, with the drives getting so big, I could literally copy my whole Mac on here 5 times.
Okay, but now you're not going to, like, when you're going to take that home and not do it on this computer, you're doing it yourself. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to back up your pictures on there because you already got them backed up on your first one, right?
This is going to be this drive is going to be probably a dedicated video audio drive.
Okay.
What I'm having trouble with is I have so much video and audio now that it's starting to get in my way of backing up other stuff.
Ah.
And sometimes it's just temporary storage, too. I tend to basically do a video, create the final product, and then I will purge the source material. Because I have the source material in another folder being backed or archived. And so I don't keep the whole project file. Because once I'm done with it, for what I do, I'm pretty much done. So that's less of an issue with me there. in some cases, we're getting a lot of podcasts now, and a lot of video podcasts, and you know, it takes us time to watch those. So it's like people find with their TiVos start to fill up because they're not watching it fast enough. they're 3 weeks behind on the House. And
yeah,
so
you ask me, did you watch such and such? I was like, no, because I'm on TiVo. I'm watching such and such.
Yeah,
but I
you're behind, it. You know. And then you hear, I'm watching the whole season of House in one night. You know,
yeah.
They'll do that, or they're watching it on DVD or whatever. So I need more storage in that regards. I am doing more video, and that's really been the big change for me, because video files can be huge. You don't even think about it. I mean, I didn't actually finish showing that, but
now for you, for somebody like me, I'll never really get big like that.
No, in most cases, for your average person, mm-hmm. the biggest concern is photos.
Yeah,
when you get a digital camera, you will surprise yourself how many pictures you can take.
Oh, I know.
Because it's not film. You're not paying for every single shot you take. And the fact is, that's a good thing, because it means you get better pictures, because the more you take, the better pictures
and
you get.
I carry a little one in my purse.
Mm-hmm.
Boomy.
Carry it along with you, right? I mean, why not? You can do that. And make sure my stream is still running here. I brought up Firefox in a different window. Okay, we still... You know, I never... Didn't record tonight, guys. Sorry.
Oh, you're kidding.
You'll have to be an audio only this week.
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't record the audio. I forgot to click the record button. Let's try and get this again here. I'll take that one. Just simply doing this little thing I did at Griffith Park with my, you know, low resolution, low frame rate digital still camera still ended up being about 8 gigs of source before I produced the final thing.
Okay, now how do you get all that printing down in your pictures?
It puts that on there automatically. That's a little like a MTV video title. And the blip does that when it shows the video. It lays that over automatically.
Really?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Douglas E. Welch, and this is Places LA. Over my
shoulder. It's going to stall a little bit here. But you see, I mean, this is comparatively fairly small.
You might be able to see one of LA's most famous landmarks.
By the way, for those of you listening to the audio podcast, you can see this video on my Blip TV site at Douglas Welch, W-E-L-C-H, at Blip. I'm sorry, douglaswelch.blip.tv.
Reopened after a multi-million dollar renovation, the Griffith Park Observatory.
And how was it?
It's excellent, actually. It's very funny. It's
come on inside.
The observatory always felt a little small and a little old. I sort of like that. There was a certain feeling about the observatory, and they've really kept it. The entire upstairs, while updated, still feels like the old observatory you grew up with.
So long.
All the new stuff is, in fact, you don't enter, I make a mention of this, you don't enter through the big brass doors anymore. You actually enter through, off on the right-hand side, there's a whole corridor that's actually a architectural sundial-based calendar.
It actually has it marked out the
solstices and all this stuff.
And
this you walk down, and then you enter by the restaurant and the store, and then into the bottom level, which is all the new level. Then there's kind of an intermediate level, and then there's the old level. The planetarium is totally redone with new chairs. No old wooden headrest anymore.
Whatever, into the main.
And very, very nice. Overall, I'm very pleased. I was not pleased with the $8 shuttle. That was the thing that really got me. And right over there is a new entrance where you see that round. That's the elevator going down to the lower level. Basically, underneath the lawn now is a whole new building.
Oh, really?
Yeah, out from the outside, it looks almost exactly like it has always looked. The structure itself has, to my eye, had no major changes to it. They've really integrated it well. But this is the camera I shot this with. And the reason I do this, there's several reasons I use this camera. And let me switch back to Ustream here. Oh, now it's going to play. One is it's easy to carry. My camcorder is bigger. I don't have a very high quality camcorder. I have a digital 8 camcorder, which is, meh on the quality. It's on tape. That means when I get done with shooting video, I have to sit there in real time and bring that video into my computer. So if I took 15 minutes of footage, it takes 15 minutes to get into my computer. This, like all digital cameras, uses a memory card. It's already digital. I take this, I throw it in my computer. This one even has a slot on the side. It only takes as long as it takes to copy it off the drive into the computer, which is a fraction of what it takes of the actual footage, you know, the actual time of the footage. It's not nearly, this is the under, this is a, the underground part of the new building.
So you can just take a memory card from a visual camera?
Yeah.
Just got one.
Yeah. Yeah. Some devices have this has a card reader built in. You can get a little card reader for your desktop PC that you just slide it in.
And how long does your video last?
I have a 1 gigabyte. When I bought this camera, I bought a 1 gigabyte memory card.
Oh, all right.
This will take well over an hour of video, and it takes 600 or 700 pictures.
Yeah.
At full res. That's the other thing I recommend is, there's the old Tesla coil up there. Yeah, this is like 80 bucks. They're cheaper now. Yeah. I got this at Costco. You can actually get these up to, I've seen them up to 8 gigabytes because there's a camcorder that a lot of the video bloggers are using that records directly to these. It's a little pistol grip thing. And it'll put an hour on an 8 gigabyte card. And again, totally digitized already. Just the time it takes to copy that file off to your computer, and you're ready to go.
So then you go and make sure that it's on your, that you've copied it off, and then you just erase it?
Yeah, I do. I make sure it's on, I copy to the computer, I make sure it's on the computer, I test it, and then I will erase this. I always start with basically a clean roll of film when I go out. I prefer to do that.
You would, yeah.
And now, the fact is, I could go buy another one of these and just swap them. There's 100 different ways. You can get two, you can easily, probably for what I paid for this 1 gig, you can get a 2 gig card easily. And, you know, that's just so many pictures. When I first went to Italy to see the family, I took 3 compact flash cards, which were the bigger square ones that my old camera took.
Yeah.
First week, I filled them up.
Oh,
luckily, our relatives had a CD burner, and I ended up burning CDs while I was there, so I could erase the cards and use them. So, you know, that's
sort
of a concern. That's the couple of reasons why you use, even though it's lower quality, and the one thing that really gets me is you saw me trying to do that stand-up.
I did.
And I can't see what I'm shooting. I have to kind of guess where the positioning is. Where with the Sanyo Zacti camcorder, you can actually turn the screen around like a regular camcorder and actually frame yourself.
So that is our trip here to Grimmel Park Observatory.
So this is me basically walking down the sidewalk like this. Recording this this little outro to this video, but you see, I mean,
weekday seem to be a great
just because our internet connection here at the library, there's a lot of people using it, and remember, video is bigger than anything else, so it does take a little while. It depends on your internet connection.
I'm gonna have to go do that just for the kick of it.
Small crowd today. We never felt rushed or crowded.
Well, yeah, and if you're at home, you'll probably it'll probably play straight through depending on your connection, because it'll just there'll be less issues with the bandwidth. I'm doing more of these. This is a series I'm doing called Places LA. It's places that we go that maybe people drive by every day or never knew existed. I don't know if you've heard. The first one I did was Stone Canyon Overlook up on Mulholland Drive. It's a beautiful little pull off the side of the road, a little overlook that overlooks Stone Canyon Reservoir and overlooks the valley on the other side. And benches and nice little decorated landscape area. But most people zoom by and they never notice it's there.
You're like Huell Hauser?
Very much so. Very much so, yeah. Hi, I'm Huell Hauser, and you're watching California's Gold. Very much in the same way.
Just earn a little money for this.
This I don't really earn much at all for. I don't have the viewership that I would really need to earn a lot of money. This is our version of home movies. Except my family can watch these at home. They can in Ohio.
Anybody.
They can see stuff.
Right.
But I'm also sharing them with the world. And so if someone's looking for information on LA and they're coming to LA and they want to see.
You say the more people that click on the video, computer, whatever.
Yeah, it's pay per click. Is typical payment for advertising.
Okay, now, but they have to go to the advertising, not just go to your.
They had to click on the ad that you saw at the bottom there. Yeah,
not just his video.
Let's see if I played that once. Let's see if we play it again. If it's already here.
Okay, we'll see. Well, Tim, this is Places LA. Over my shoulder, you might be able to
now,
see.
Now I can also do
LA's most famous landmark.
Full screen.
Recently reopened after a multi-million-dollar renovation.
For my stuff,
Come on inside and let's check out what's old and
some
what's new.
Specific keywords pay dollars a click, and I get a few of those every now and then on my website. But usually it's
one small change about the observatory is that the youth center through these doors behind me is kind of grand.
Like 3 years.
I haven't been there since they remodeled.
Into the main kind of grand entrance of the observatory. But now you
so I'm seeing things like
there. To the new entrance on the side, which leads down to the new second level.
And so this is, you know, this is an example of our home movies. I don't take home movies, even of Joe, that much, you know, just sitting around the house doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're out somewhere, when I talk about podcasting to people, they often I get the comment, well, God, I don't have time to do this. It takes too much time. It's like, you're going to go there anyway. Why wouldn't you just do this?
Yeah.
I just walked around and just took movies while I was there. And when I came home, if I had something that that I could edit into a little piece. And this is the old part of the, you know, the upstairs part of the museum. It's been all cleaned and refurbished and all that stuff. And the Tesla coil is still there. And the displays have all been, they're a little shuffled around from where they were. They're very cleaned up and neatened up. And they have a very neat, that's a Tesla coil. It's actually a huge, invented by Nikola Tesla, it's a huge power generator that arcs into the, if you look inside, there's a metal cage inside, and it's actually arcing to the metal cage. It's a lightning generator, if you will. Yeah. They're actually, in the past, in the old museum, they did a demonstration where they would stand there with a fluorescent tube in their hand,
so guys, what
and there's so much electromagnetic energy coming off that
show?
That actually the tube will glow in their hand, not connected to anything.
Here to Griffith Park Observatory. I'll tell you what, weekdays seem to be a great time to visit. It was a small crowd today. We never felt rushed or crowded, no matter what we were doing. We even took
there were some, but it's very, 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 very nice. We had a pretty good time.
This way.
Yeah.
Come by the Griffith Park Observatory. Now open here in Griffith Park, near Central Los Angeles. You can find more information on the web.
Oh, they have a miniature version, a huge model of Mount Palomar Observatory. And they have, you can open the shutters and rotate the dome and move the telescope inside. And these guys thought that was that's one of the old things. It's been there for decades.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, still a very, the planetarium show was very neat. They have a new projector now in the planetarium that is amazing. And they can do video and stuff on the dome now, which is, they didn't quite have enough of the planetarium projector in the show that we saw. Although the show, but I have to say this, the planetarium show we saw was phenomenal. The presenter, this woman, is great. She should be in movies because, I mean, it was just one of the best presentations I've seen in years.
You make me want to go to this.
Really emotional, really still had all the scientific information that needed to be displayed, but wasn't boring in any way. Very emotional about it. This is where we live in the cosmos, and, you know, zooming out, you know, basically, and talk about the Big Bang for a little bit. And, you know, major astronomical discoveries, were made right here in Southern California, up at Mount Wilson. Hubble first found evidence of the Big Bang at Mount Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
So some amazing stuff that went on here. So it's...
Okay, where's the ad on here?
Right, one, there's a webpage ad right down here.
Where?
Right down here at the bottom. This is a web ad where it says California.
Okay. I was
and then when you play... Well, let me play another one here. These are some of my other videos. Oh, here, we'll do this one.
So,
you know, I talk about home movies.
Need you toy for Christmas.
And you'll see the overlay ad appear. There's sometimes an ad at the end, too, that comes up full screen.
That's where I was looking down at the bottom.
Yeah.
So how can someone find this? I mean, can they go to Google?
Well, what's nice with a service like this, you can actually embed these videos on your own website. And, in fact, all these videos that you're seeing here through Blip were actually embedded as little videos like you would a YouTube video or anything else on my blog called My Word. Or
they just go to Douglas Welch.
They go to my website, and then looking through my weblog, they see these videos embedded right there on the page, and they can play them right there on the page. They don't have to come here. I'm using this because they're all in one place here, and it's just a little easier to demonstrate them. But this is a silly one. There's no production to this at all. I don't even think I put a tag at the end of it because it was just playing around Christmas Day. Was it Christmas Day?
Yeah.
No, it's the day after because Mom had to return the original one we got and get a new one because the first one didn't work.
Oh, really?
You'll see the video.
We'll see when it starts here. So that's, you know, someone was very impressed with the Griffith Park one, which is there's all sorts of flaws with it.
Toys for Christmas, and
you can tell I had a cold over Christmas. I'm all stuffed up.
Well,
on the
everybody
video.
Did.
Everyone was very sick over Christmas. But the fact is, it is engaging. For example, imagine someone was coming to LA and they wanted to see what the Griffith Park Observatory looked like. Well, it's not far from a polished presentation, but they got the flavor of our day there.
Yep.
I didn't show them the restaurant.
You guarantee that I'm going to get to
play
with this.
Fairly decent prices.
So here we go.
Your son had shot this for you. And
he could do that too. Both him and my wife are kind of herky-jerky with the camera. I've had them help me. I've just been holding my. I just usually do it myself. having a camera that had a front display or had a display I could turn around would be. Then I could really do it nicely. But you know,
okay, Joe.
Okay, what is that?
It's a little tiny helicopter about this big.
It is, isn't it?
Yep.
We're having a little issue with that. Works great. We've gotten some lint wrapped around the rotor blade. And I'm having a hard time getting it out, but I'll keep working at it. And we got it almost, it's almost back where it was when we started, yeah.
It's
amazing. It's very, this one is very resilient. The first one we got, you could not control it. It would just uncontrollably spin. So this Christmas day, I'm trying to figure out how to fly it. This one you can actually steer around and fly around the house. It's not totally under control because you don't have, you're missing one axis of control that you get with the helicopter, which is forward and back. But you can actually really have a good time with it.
Oh, my God.
Very tiny, very light, but pretty fun. Pretty fun. So this is just a little video I shot, again, with this camera, Christmas, day after Christmas, and, you know, put it up.
And who got that? You got it? Or
Joe
got it.
Me.
Oh, you.
I got some playtime with it, though. You know, Joe's piano recital school program. And then when I go out and do podcasting presentations, you know, I make sure that I record, like I do here with the classes, I record everything I do. So I've integrated it into my life so that I'm not going out and forcing myself to do new, you know, more work. I'm merely doing what I can to capture the stuff I'm doing throughout my life. And that's what I tell my podcasting people a lot. If you're going out to do something anyway, why not record?
Why not?
It doesn't take that much more effort. Sometimes it works, sometimes it, and the point is not to stress. If you're doing something and you're like, oh, this is too much, then put it away. Just let it go and just enjoy what you're doing and know that you're not going to capture that day. But so many people create lots of content every day and then they throw it away. And it's content that other people would really like. I mean, you'd be surprised. I get letters all the time from people about, you know, oh, that was great. And, you know, it's so nice seeing that, you know, in real life and, you know, stuff like that. When we were going to Hawaii the first time, there was a guy video blogging out there and I watched all of his video blogs. And it was like, so when we got there, it's like, oh, okay, I know where we are now, and I know, go this way to go there, and it's perfect. He gave me a great little introduction into Oahu.
Very much so.
And introduced me to the culture, because we like to learn about the culture a lot, too, when we're in our places. We made a point in Hawaii to visit the traditional
Haiyaus,
the religious sites, and some other neat, really neat places that a lot of people like. We came back like, you went where?
Yeah.
You know, so that was pretty fun. We had a good time with that. So this is, you know, I was giving this talk anyway. Why wouldn't I have recorded it so that I can share it with people? And I did audio and video.
Okay, but who is recording? Where's the camera?
My camcorder was sitting in a tripod, say over there.
Over there.
I just set it up, frame it, and start it. In this case, when I'm doing a presentation, as you might imagine, if the camera's that far away, the audio is pretty lousy because it's too far away. So what I do is I take my iRiver. And I plug in my lavalier mics to the iRiver. I stick it in my pocket, and then at the end, I then sync them up back on the computer, so you have the high quality audio with the video.
Oh, I'll bet you that's why sometimes I see where not you.
No, that's why
it's when they're off a tap.
It'll fade, yeah.
They're off a
because tap. These aren't professional devices. Professional devices have what's called time code.
Well, I even saw it on a news broadcast the other night.
That, what happens is the time code gets off.
Yeah.
So these don't have time code at all, and so I'm only doing a best approximation, and they will fall out after.
Oh, they will.
In this case, I've done as long as like 25, 30 minutes, and still be good enough.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
If I turn on both audio tracks, I can actually hear it starting to fall out of sync. But it's anything with like a half second. Will be okay, but with Pro devices, since they both have time code moving at exactly the same time, they can actually they basically resync themselves
line
at each time
right
point,
up.
So they never fall out of sync. But that's equipment's really expensive.
Well, I was watching a podcast the other day, and that was off. They were just off a tad, not enough to annoy me because sometimes if it's
sometimes
too much,
it's really bad.
And I can't. Want to
walk. You know, at the beginning of that Griffith Park one, for some reason, my first stand-up at the beginning is out of sync, and I don't know at what point it happened necessarily that it fell out of sync, but you know, you do what you can. Sometimes
okay,
you just have to say.
To you?
Yeah, we have four viewers in the stream up at the very top. Right, right. Well, now three viewers. See, now you chased them away.
Oh,
see?
Man.
And our
viewers.
Yeah, that's three viewers right now. Marv is from coming in from Kaneohe, Oahu, Hawaii. He's someone I know, and Mark Shepard might be in from Wichita. He's been. They've joined us before. There.
So, anyone watching this podcaster, you know how many?
Yeah, I see I, in the right hand of the list of names, I see, you know, basically there are three names in the chat, besides my own and the little bot, and then I have that viewer number changes as people come in and leave.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was open to general worldwide.
It is, it is, but people have to, you know, that number is how many people are actively watching
it. That are actually watching it.
But I didn't know you would know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They try to give you that so you have some idea what's going on.
Interesting.
Oh, so anyway, any question further about the external hard drive?
Oh, it's kind of cool.
You know, it just happened to be that I...
Well, is this any different than any other hard drive?
No, all of the external hard drives, basically inside of this is the hard drive that you would put in, like, inside a computer. Mm-hmm. It's just in an external box with the connectors on it.
This used to be very expensive, but now they...
Yeah, I mean, it's the size, the capacity. 500 gigabytes was unheard of. I mean, it's tens of thousands of dollars. Now, as I said, it's $140. And the terabyte one, I think, was $250. That's like...
Yeah,
everything comes down in price.
And, you know, we're still working under Moore's Law, which is Moore's Law was originally stated as the number of transistors in a chip can be doubled every 18 months, and the price cut in half. And pretty much
number
of transistors in a chip can be doubled for half the cost in 18 months. And basically, we have held to that since the invention of integrated circuits. That's why we have such powerful devices now, you know, that we can carry around in our hand for a couple $100 that do something that you couldn't physically do 10 years ago. I mean,
isn't it?
10 years ago you could, but it was lower quality.
I feel bad because I've got great big cameras. I mean, I have...
Film cameras?
Film cameras.
Yeah.
I actually...
Now, if you bought lenses for those, there are some cameras that you can actually use your original lenses at least.
I don't have the But I even have like a $500 digital and I use my little...
Yeah, I'm actually going to do one last thing with the hard drive, which is I want to unplug it. Because typically when you're done using the drive, you don't want to do this when you're actually writing data to it, but we're going to unplug it. We should hear. Doo-doo. So when it goes doom-doom, that means you've added a device. Doom-doom means you've disconnected a device. Standard Windows sounds similar but slightly different on a Windows XP machine. And then we're done, and basically when I did that, I basically powered off the drive. So, yes, we can. I'll ask her anything you want. Hi, Marv.
Well, since I don't know computers and I haven't bought one yet and, you know, just learning, when did Windows start? I mean, when did...
Windows. I've been through every version of Windows. Windows started with Windows. I think it was like there was something even before I think I started. The first one I touched was Windows 386, and that would have been 1986.
1986.
Yeah, that was Windows 386 for the 386 computers. It ran multiple DOS applications in Windows.
Someone having a PC was practical. At that point?
Well, at that time, the state-of-the-art of the machine would have been the 386 computer with about maybe a 20 meg, I have to remind myself, a 20 megabyte hard drive and a 5 1/4 inch floppy. At that time, it was the biggest, you know. What's funny is at that time, the biggest amount of hard drive space that a PC could access was 32 meg. And so if you had a bigger drive, you actually had to divide it up into 32 megabyte partitions to use it.
That's back where where you had all the machines, right? Mainframe?
No. Well, mainframes were still around at that time. Definitely, they were on their way out. The PC really brought, the original IBM PC really started to bring the end of the mainframe era and I won't say mainframe, but mini computers were kind of a subset of that. The system 36 to system 360 were kind of these, we call them mainframes, but they were literally more mini computers. They would fit in a room, for example, and then they served a bunch of terminals.
Right.
They kind of overlapped with the PC world. I mean, they're still mainframes today in name.
Okay, the 360, I think that's how I started.
Yeah, I mean, you had a big terminal, and the terminal was screen-based. When you did something, it would redraw the whole screen and, you know, usually green text. So that's, you know, where Windows was started. So that was 86 when I first touched it. And then it, you know, Windows 386, Windows 3.1.
Basically come out with the smaller PCs,
Well, you have the PC XT, which was the old, you know, that was the first one with a hard drive for your personal computer world. You had the Apple II line paralleling this for a long time there, too. I was an Apple II person. Then you moved up into the 386, the 486. That was the, you know, early 90s when I was working at Disney. Then the Pentium chips, they realized they couldn't copyright the phrase 586 because it's generic. So they had to make the new names. That's when you started getting names like the Pentium, the Pentium 2, the Pentium 3.
Because I thought it was like 95, Windows 95, wasn't that?
Windows 95 was the first iteration of what we now see today. Windows 3.1, which was before that, or Windows 3.1, was still very DOS-like. It basically was just a pretty face on DOS. Windows 95 still, I mean, even today, Windows still has a lot of kind of hidden DOS underpinnings there. And 95 and up started to get away from, they started removing those DOS elements, that text-based command line elements. Then Windows 95 went to Windows 98, and everything then has been pretty much a progression to Windows 2000. XP, Windows 2000. Well, there was another one in there, Windows ME. Horrible.
Was that a bad one?
It was horrible. Luckily, it wasn't around very long. Millennium Edition, so right around the 2000 time period. For whatever reason, it just was horrible. It was just abysmal to work with. It was very non-robust. Then Windows XP, which was their longest iteration, while they were working on Vista, which is what I'm running here, you know, Vista has less and less counterparts of that DOS world in there. There are certain things you can no longer do on your computer that you used to be able to do up until Vista, as far as...
Name something.
Well, the command line is different now. It's not really a true DOS command line. It's kind of a faked command line now, and stuff like that. But, you know, Vista's had its issues, too, about stability and robustness. They're just getting ready now to come out with Service Pack 1 for Vista, which will be their first big update of Microsoft Windows System. Pardon?
Have you had problems? You have Vista on this, right?
Well, I have Vista on this. I would say that I have not had any more problems with Vista on this machine, which came with it and was designed for it, than I would have with an average XP install.
Oh, okay.
It's Windows. You know.
So if you had an older computer and... They went to XP or Vista.
I told my clients, do not upgrade to Vista.
I didn't. My new computer is XP, not Vista.
Mainly because the way the Macintosh ads poked fun at, I need to replace my video card, my hard drive. You basically end up, because Vista is a more powerful operating system, requires more powerful equipment to run, a lot of computers just didn't have the horsepower to run it. And so I just told everyone across the board, which is my typical thing of, use the computer until it dies, and then when you get the new computer, it will have the new operating system on it. I bought this computer with this operating system on it with the reasonable assurance that it would work, and for the most part, it has. I've had a few tiny glitches. I actually ran into a problem with a client's computer that was totally esoteric and totally mind-blowing in dealing with QuickTime movies in iTunes for moving them to the iPod. Mm-hmm. There's actually an issue where it was corrupting the files, and it was totally Vista. We moved it to a Windows XP machine, and the problem went away. So it totally was related to Vista, and I sort of found some information about it. But that was probably the biggest problem I run into specifically that I can point at Vista and say this was a Vista problem.
Okay, question: When you ran into that, you Googled something to find out.
Typically, if I have run into a problem where I haven't seen it before, I will Google it, yeah.
And you went into Google and said, like, why are the files being corrupted when I...
We were getting an actual error number in that case.
We were getting
an actual error, and I put that error in.
And it brought you up to the blog?
It didn't tell me exactly what was wrong. It took me a while to figure out what... I had to kind of go through a little bit to figure out what exactly was wrong.
But there were other people
who had experienced a problem, thank goodness. I mean, you always hope that.
I'm just trying to remember because I know somebody did that on something. Actually, the Google and the language. Mm-hmm. The girl didn't know to go to the preferences to change it to...
Yeah, to change the Spanish
language.
But
she went and said, I can't get Google in English or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And
Yeah, and I couldn't remember, but she just typed that in the Google Live,
yeah.
Right?
Okay. Well, you're calling on millions of minds out there, and the fact is somebody out there probably has experienced a problem you're experiencing. I had one the other day, though. I could not find any mention of it, and I finally solved it myself, and therefore then I wrote it up, so if anyone else experiences a problem,
they can find it.
And that is my dock on my Mac was just not work. It just wouldn't rise up. I'd move my mouse down, and it wouldn't work. I'd have to click to make it pop up. Variety of other things. It's like, what the heck's going on? And finally realized what had happened is if I accidentally kicked out my USB keyboard and then replugged it in, it freaks it out. You have to restart and everything was back, but if just plugging it back in, it would freak out the dock.
Oh, really?
Who knows why, but I finally figured that out. So, of course, I wrote that up. Anything I discover, I write it for other people. I was having trouble delivering M4V iPod-ready video files for as podcasts from my website. It just wouldn't do it. And so, I figured that one out, and so I posted that one. And it was just a setting, and, people have to change something on their website to do it. But I figured it out.
What's the difference between your MP and my iPod Nano?
Nothing. Your iPod Nano plays M4V video files. No, the Fatty will actually play video, and that's the file type that you would play on an iPod. It's called an M4V file. It's an MPEG-4 file is what it is.
Okay, but I mean an MP3 player?
An MP3 player. There are other MP3 players, like this one, that aren't iPods. In fact, there's a whole...
Right.
Creative has their whole Zen line.
So
Microsoft has their Zunes. I mean, there's tons of other players out there. So I always try to keep it generic.
The same thing. It's just the iPod's the iPod.
I try to be nice and kind and use the generic term MP3 player player.
Right, right.
Because you can't tell what people have.
Yeah, but I didn't know that.
But that's why I say that, though. That's exactly why I say that. Yes.
Well, again, basically.
Oh, by the way, Marv said there is a movie called Pirates of Silicon Valley, which will kind of give you this nice overview of the history.
I saw the four down here. Are those your...
Pardon?
I mean,
these people here?
I know you have four viewers, but...
Sometimes the viewers in the chats do not always match
like
up.
Mad Marv.
Matt Marv is a friend of mine who lives in Hawaii. Mm. Aloha. And we've actually met. When we visited Hawaii, I specifically went and said, let's have lunch. And I actually met Marv.
Fun.
And Marv has actually been out here to our podcast expo a couple times,
okay,
so I've gotten to meet him there too.
Tell him to watch Pirates of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, there's a movie you can find. I think that's a fictionalized, it's a movie, but there are also tremendous documentaries out there in Silicon Valley. They give you this whole... and there's books, obviously, that there's even one called, it's called Hackers. Gives you the prehistory, how the first computer hackers grew out of the Model Train Club at MIT.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If I wanted to know how to hack into such and such, could I?
La, 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 la. I don't hear anything. What's funny is the term hacking, by the way, this is just a nerdy thing, but hacking usually means creative programming, creative building, creative invention.
Really?
If you're looking for the term for malicious attacks and malicious break-ins, it's usually called cracking.
Ah.
The media makes no differentiation between the two, unfortunately, but in the tech world, those are crackers. We are hackers. But the term has kind of got usurped over the years.
Well, what I was going to ask is, since I'm really new at this,
mm-hmm.
Okay, there's Apple, there's different computers, Apple.
There's different manufacturers, right?
Apple, Macintosh, but,
There were, at the beginning, there were many, 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 many more types of computers and types of manufacturers. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in the day, the inside was one of the first ones, which basically had no display. It had little switches on the front, and the lights would blink, and you could program it that way. Then they had terminals you could attach to it. But there was probably, 30, 40, 50 manufacturers of computers at that time. Mm-hmm. It's consolidated more and more. What happened was...
It's
Apple and then the Windows-based computers.
Windows is Apple.
Windows is Microsoft.
Oh, it is. Oh.
Windows is Microsoft. That's their competitors. Apple has a fraction of the market that Microsoft has. Apple, has like 8% of the market.
I thought Apple was...
You wouldn't believe it if you walked into one of their stores.
Well, and that's partially what they're doing is really working hard.
So Microsoft is just another...
Microsoft started making software for one of these, for the Altair computer. They wrote a version of BASIC, BASIC programming language for the Altair computer on paper tape, delivered it on paper tape. That was their first piece of software. And... Bill Gates was living in a trailer in the parking lot of the company that manufactured the computers. So he had access to the computers in order to finish the copy and paste. This is the prehistory computers. Then the next big change was IBM, you know, Apple came out with their Apple I and the Apple II, and then eventually the Apple III, which failed, but that and VisiCalc were like the first bang, you know, that when people saw that they could do spreadsheets on their own computer, not through a mainframe, not having to share with other people, not having to submit punch cards, that was really the beginning. VisiCalc was probably the real business chink in the armor. People were buying, executives were buying Apple IIs at several thousands of dollars a piece specifically to run VisiCalc, which was a spreadsheet program that allowed them to do calculations and stuff. Then IBM said, okay, fine, we're going to get into this world too. We're going to make the IBM PC. And that was when it really got in the doors of most offices.
IBM?
The IBM PC. Built around the same guidelines as their mainframes. Big, chunky, metal keyboards that went kush, 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 you know, I mean.
With punch cards? I mean, when did it?
Well, I went to school in, I started college in 1982. Yeah, I know. And, okay, how do you think I feel when people tell me that they weren't born in 1982?
How do you think I feel?
In 1982, I missed punch cards by one semester in college. The punch card machine was still there and was still being used when I started my classes. We were using floppy disks to submit our jobs to the mainframe for my first class.
So it changed like in 82?
Yeah, around that time, at least in my college. Probably more fancier colleges, probably sooner. But in my college, it was 1982, I can tell you exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of overlap there. PCs, I spent so much time in the computer lab using the Apple IIs. I've preferred them. Looking at the green screen so long that when I would look up away from the screen, everything would have a red tinge around it.
We didn't have computer labs.
We had several big computer labs. I mean, I literally, when I went to college, that freshman fall semester, I had access to computers full-time for the first time in my life, and I realized I had an aptitude for it. I was already starting to teach people how to use computers that freshman quarter, and that's where my whole career started, basically. And so I realized, hey, I can actually do this, and cool. And yeah, sort of took off from there.
What's really confusing to me is, like, in the past, were DOS or...
DOS was... The disk, it stands for Disk Operating System. And it was a command line-driven language. You know, you had to type in commands, and the computer would talk back at you.
But you don't need to know that now, do you?
Not really. There are still some things today, even today, that I will drop to a command line in Vista and do. I need to check the status of a network connection, for example, or something like that. Usually as a pair of troubleshooting stuff, yeah, I'll drop there. But that's me being old school, honestly. Now, the Mac operating system nowadays, Mac OS X, is all built on top of a Unix operating system, which is one of the beginning mini computer operating systems. I keep a terminal window open on my Mac every day, because I actually have some scripts that I run there, and I can do some stuff with the command line. Again, probably because I'm old school, but sometimes it's just simpler to do things that way. I would never want to go back to the days of WordPerfect and Microsoft Word and the DOS world. It was really difficult. WordPerfect was a nightmare.
I loved it.
Oh, I hate it. Everyone who used it loved it except for me. I hated it because I had to support it.
I could even type in macro, even in macro.
Yep.
I loved it.
And then you started getting these graphical, the GUIs, the graphical user interface. That started with Windows. Don't hit me out there. I'm going to correct myself, okay? Give me 5 seconds. Graphical user interface started with a man named Doug Engelbart. And you can still find that video online today. Mark's giving me a countdown. He's going to chew me out. Doug Engelbart, I got it, okay? Okay. He's the man who invented the mouse. A piece of wood with two wheels, basically, created a whole system using this graphical user interface. It's also called a WIMP interface for Windows icons, mouse, and pointer.
When was that?
That was
the mouse.
The mouse, I'm going to say, was, I'd have to look in Wikipedia. I'm going to say late 70s.
The mouse?
Yeah, because these were systems that basically used a mainframe for their processing, but they had a mouse on the terminal to talk to it. Then you had Xerox produce the first commercial graphic user interface computer, and it was called the Star, I believe. And I remember that Charlie Chan Printing down in Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood had one and did all their desktop publishing on it. That is where, when anyone ever says, oh, the Mac just stole their interface, well, that's where the Mac interface started. They took the Star interface, and Xerox was unable to make that into a real product. But when Steve Jobs saw that, that was the beginning of the Mac. He saw this. This is where it's at. This is what we need to do. We need a graphical user interface for computers. Why are we still typing in commands and hitting function keys? We should be able to use a mouse to tell the computer what we want to do. And that's where the first Mac came out, then the Fat Mac, then the Mac Plus, and so on and so on and so forth. You know, I haven't really thought about it that much. Because unfortunately, I mean, last time we visited Smithsonian when he was 5 months old at the Museum of the American History, which are just remodeling right now. It's closed right now. It's always been my favorite museum of the Smithsonian. They have a computer history area. And, you know, of course, they start at the end of the timeline and start working through, and I realize I start very close to the beginning of that timeline going, use that, touch that, use that, had one of those, you know, and it's like, you know, you realize how much history you've been over in the computer world. The transition of computers has been very, very quick. You may not seem it at times, but it's been very, very quick. We're doing stuff now with our 500 gigabyte drives that doing what we do. That little video you saw me do would have taken $100,000 only 10, 12, yeah, maybe not 12 years ago, maybe 14 years ago. I'm getting older. I have to adjust my timelines. But, you know, back when I was working at Disney, we had a system called an Avid system, the precursor to the Avid you hear now that's used for television editing, that was, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to buy if you wanted to do video editing on a computer, what they call, you know, offline video editing. So hopefully that's illuminated things a little bit for you. I mean, now we're talking, my wife has actually started to use this computer to dictate for the first time, actually dictate to the computer and have it translated into text.
Oh, okay.
Her hands are getting a little tired of typing so much. And so we've started doing some dictation with her. It actually comes built in with Vista. Actually...
Oh, it does come built in?
Yeah, actually it's worked fairly well. The Apple has voice recognition, but not dictation out of the box. But you can buy dictation software for it.
You can. Somebody in my apartment building bought
Dragon, naturally speaking, is considered one of the top of the line, but that's only for PCs. You know, voice recognition is a nearly impossible nut to crack. We are so variable in how we say things and how the computer hears us that it's very, very difficult. More difficult than anyone ever imagined when we started.
I would imagine, like, my voice right now, because I had an operation in November, and then I have a cold on top of it.
Yeah.
So now my
you have to train, you know, we've trained hers. What's nice is it does learn as you dictate. So if it makes an error, you stop and say, correct that word and select the right word you meant, and it'll actually remember that. And it will start to develop a database of your voice over time that hopefully as you use it more and more, it gets more and more accurate. Sometimes it's spookily accurate. I mean, it'll get a whole three-sentence thing, and then all of a sudden it'll, you know, say barf instead of book or something, you know. It's hard to tell. And obviously if you get, you know, you bang the microphones, it thinks you're trying to say something and it's just noise and it'll, you know, put garbage up on the screen.
Oh, will it? Oh, yeah.
What
if the phone rings in the background?
Yeah, it'll, anything it picks up is trying to translate its text. You very quickly say, stop listening. And it goes, and then, you know, stops listening for a time until you say, start listening again, and then it comes back up. I want to thank you all for joining us tonight.
This is fun.
Sorry I wasn't able to record the video, guys. I clicked one button but didn't click the other. So you will be able to listen to this as an audio podcast, though, directly from welchwrite.com/techIQ. That's welchwrite.com/techIQ. If you have any questions for future seminars, please send them in via email. Join us here live. Put them in the chat room. We'd love to hear from you. We will have our next class in 2 weeks, so today is the 10th, so on January 17th, that sounds correct, no, 2 weeks, so January 24th, I believe, will be our next class Thursday night, is that right?
24th.
So we'll see you then, join us again, thanks everybody for joining us tonight, and have a great night.
This show is a production of WelchWrite.com, WelchWrite.com.